Okay. So, the following interview was conducted on behalf of the oral history program of the Century High School. The interviewee is Mike Kruger. The interviewer is Lanisha Mora. The interview took place at the Juvenile Services Department on Tuesday, May 24th at 4 o'clock p.m. Our research question is, describe and analyze changes and trends in crime and law enforcement in Hillsborough, Oregon from 1980 to 2005. So what is your relationship to this question?
I've been employed with the juvenile department since 1979 in a variety of different positions. I started out transporting kids that were in custody as an admissions counselor, and then for several years I carried a caseload as a probation officer, and now I'm one of the department managers overseeing staff.
Okay, so you started from, so how long have you been living in Hillsborough?
Since I moved here in January of 1979. There are certainly some general trends that we've seen in terms of the kind of cases that come through the juvenile department, and that's probably, you know, in terms of law enforcement and their techniques, you know, that's probably something that, you know, police or somebody would probably respond better. But I think, you know, there's a lot of just general specialization in a lot of different areas, and certainly in Washington County and Hillsborough, there's, you know, as departments get more, as they get larger, you know, things get more sophisticated, it gets more specialized, and I think you see that in law enforcement as well as, you know, the juvenile court.
So what made you get involved into the juvenile department, though? Why this department?
This particular department? Well, basically, I was living in Kansas. When I graduated from college, I got a job as a probation officer in a small county in Kansas, and after about 3.5 years there, didn't want to stay in Kansas anymore, and so I looked for other opportunities and sent letters out to different states, other departments, just asking questions about, do you have openings, is it a state agency, you know, and this is one of the departments that responded to my letters, and, you know, we liked Oregon, and so probably about 6 months after I interviewed, I came out and interviewed, and about 6 months later they called and said, we have this admissions job if you're interested, and I said, I am, and so we moved out specifically to Hillsborough, the department.
So, in 2005, your view, what types of crimes were happening in Hillsborough?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, you're going to see more property offenses. You know, we see in lots and lots of shoplifting or minor thefts. So that's very, very common. You know, physical harassment, fights, you know, things that happen in schools is pretty common. Criminal mischief where you're damaging, your property's damaged. You know, that's pretty common in terms of criminal charges. We certainly see runaways and curfew violations and all those kinds of things too. You know, I think Washington County and Hillsborough in particular, you know, we don't see the number of person-to-person offenses, serious assaults, those kinds of things. What we see here, I think, is pretty typical, just for a community this size. You know, it's going to be minor thefts, you know, property offenses, primarily.
How many kids or people on average come into this facility? Like, I don't mean every day, but like,
right.
They get charged.
What we count as a referral, for a year, we count a referral as if the police charge a youth with something. Now again, it can be something as minor as a curfew or possession of tobacco, clear up to, you know, stealing cars and burglaries and all that kind of stuff. Our referrals actually have been declining over the last about 4 or 5 years. If you want me to, I can give you specific numbers, because we have it like for the last 5 years. We just have our performance measures out. And actually, I can show you, if there's more information you want when we're done, This is something that's on the web, in our website, and it gives you all kinds of information. And I'm trying to find our total referrals here. Yes, if you want to stop, we can do that. We are in the range of, the total referrals, or total number of cases handled in 1998, for example, because we're not going all the way back, but in 1998, our total referrals for a year were roughly 4,600. In 2004, we've actually come down to about 3,300.
So it's significantly reduced.
Right. And during the time that you're talking about, I mean, there was, in the probably late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot of pretty serious, criminal stuff happening, nationwide, and then there was a trend where those kind of offenses started declining, and we have seen that here. And we've done a lot of things as a department to try and not have kids reoffend. You have a number of youth who, they get arrested once or twice, and their parents take action, or they learn from it, or they just never do it again. And then there's a very small percentage of kids, roughly 8 to 12% of the kids are responsible for more than half of the actual referrals that come in. And that's a real small number of kids that are just always in trouble. And so what we have tried to do is identify who those kids are very early and get services in particular to that group, so that if you can stop those kids from reoffending, then you really can make an impact on, on their other offenses in the future. And so that's one of the efforts that we have made, is to really try and target and identify who those kids are, and also just have effective programs so that the kids that are referred to us, get hopefully what they need out of our department, so that they don't reoffend in the future.
So what kind of programs or what kind of techniques do you use in order to help these kids with their problems? Like, do you have specific programs for specific things?
We do, and they've developed over time. A few different things, I guess. One is we recognize that just because a youth is arrested doesn't mean that they're destined for a life of crime. Getting in trouble once and making, maybe it's a shoplifting, their parents take action, things happen to them, and there's a number of those kids aren't going to do it again anyway. So we really try and put resources where they're needed the most. One of the things in particular that we did starting in about 1995, 1996, was to really specialize a program to deal with that small number of kids. There was some research out of California that kind of helped identify what to look for. And so two of the units I supervise, one is called the assessment unit, and that's sort of our intake unit. That's where most new cases start. So when we meet with families, we do an interview and we try and get some information of how do they do at home, how do they do at school, are they involved with drugs and alcohol, what kind of activities are their friends involved in, how are the parents, do they have the ability to parent and set limits and supervise and do all that kind of stuff. So right at the very beginning, we try and identify which kids are most likely to reoffend and put special attention to those kids, having them make restitution so they understand, or repay, a victim so that they understand what they do has consequences. It may be community service. And part of it is just supervision and trying to get maybe counseling programs, if they're involved in drugs and alcohol, to try and get an evaluation done, get them into treatment, really kind of proactive things, so that if they take advantage of those, hopefully they won't reoffend. But we've really tried to specialize with that group so that they don't get into that pattern of reoffending. We have a specialized drug and alcohol program now where it's very much based on education and having the parents involved, so it's not just the kid kind of doing this all by themselves, you know, to have the parent support. So we've done a lot of different things to try and identify that, and just the way we do business, the probation officers, we have expectations about how often kids are seen. If they're on probation, they're seen by the probation officer. The rules are enforced. If they're not complying, you know, they can come back to court. So we really try and hold kids accountable for, you know, so that they are responsible for what they do. But again, we also push really hard for counseling and treatment and positive things, so that it's not just, well, don't do that anymore. Okay, what am I going to do? And to try and give them the alternative things to and support parents.
So what do you think they're influenced by? Like, if they do any kind of crime, what's the thing they're most influenced by?
The cause?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really hard, and that's one of the issues. Part of it is some of the kids are in trouble just because they used horrible judgment. You know, they just didn't think about what they were doing. Certainly peers can be part of that. You know, if a person, a young person is more likely to get in trouble if their peers support that kind of activity, or they're more likely to use drugs if their friends use drugs. It's not a guarantee, but it does increase the chances. So part of it is just immaturity and, you know, poor judgment at the time. Sometimes it is drug and alcohol based, where that really is the driving force. They're addicted, or at least they're abusing, and so they get kind of caught up in supporting their addiction and making choices under the influence that is not good. Some of it is, you know, lack of supervision. The parents just are really not attending to what the kids are doing. There's too much freedom, no accountability. And there are, you know, there are a select few kids that there really are, you know, there are some criminal thinking, and there is an attitude of, you know, what's out there is mine. If I want something, I can take it, and, you know, they don't care about the consequences or the impact on other people.
So, what is your outlook on Measure 11? Like, is it fair to try a 15-year-old or whatever as an adult, or is it effective?
You want my personal opinion?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is my personal opinion. This is not reflective of the department overall. I'm not personally in favor of Measure 11 as it applies to juveniles. Part of it has to do with, and I understand why the voters did it. I mean, I know all that, and I understand why they voted for it. Prior to Measure 11, there was a process in place called a waiver, where if you felt somebody should be transferred to adult court, there was a court process where you took it before a judge, you presented your case, and the judge made a decision about whether they should, you know, be tried as an adult or not. I think, you know, some of these laws are passed because there may not be equitable enforcement of some of those kinds of things. And I think when Measure 11 was passed, at least the first time, I don't think there was a clear understanding by the public of, I think people had the concept of, oh, okay, it's these adults that are that really need to be locked up. And I, you know, that there are some that should be. I don't know that everybody understood necessarily that it went clear to 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds. So my personal perspective is, I think we had the ability to make those decisions anyway, and I'm not really supportive that, based strictly on a charge, that somebody should go to adult court. Just, you know, just based on the charge, which is really what Measure 11 does. I think the improvement has been that as Measure 11 has been law for a longer period of time, by the district attorney's office, there's greater thought given to, you know, for example, if a young person is 16 and they're charged with assault 2, you know, they've never been in trouble before, maybe there's some extenuating circumstances, the DA's office does have the ability to have them plead to something less, like drop to an attempted. There's some legal pleadings they can do that will help lessen maybe the time, or at least set up circumstances where after they've served half their time, if they've done well, they're given more consideration. It's called the second look. So I think as time has gone by, that has been, that's an improvement. But it is, I'm not sure if it's more difficult. I guess it's difficult for both. When the 16-year-old gets charged, they've never been in trouble, you know, they can go to the county jail, and in Washington County they do. If they're 16 and it's a major 11, they're held in the county jail as an adult. So that's pretty dramatic. It's also very troubling to parents who walk in and think, well, this is my son, he's, you know, a junior in high school, he's never been in trouble. What do you mean he's going to the county jail and he's going to be with all those other criminals? And parents really are very troubled by that sometimes too, I think. And I don't think that there's enough public education done at the high school level to have youth aware of what Major 11 is and how quickly it can go from, you know, trying to steal some beer to all of a sudden, you know, the clerk stops them, so they say, well, leave us alone or we'll shoot you, and they pretend to have a weapon. All of a sudden it's gone from just stealing some beer to a Major 11. And I think that's, I mean, it's just a very significant change. And I don't think that the public necessarily understands how quickly it can go from something less to something so, so severe.
So do you think it causes more of a problem than
prevention? I don't know that it really causes more of a problem. I think that in some ways it's hard to know what the impact is going to be, because for those juveniles that were sentenced under Major 11 and got that maximum time, many of those are just now probably getting to the point where they're completing their sentences and they're going to be coming back into the community. And I think it's going to be, we need to see, okay, did they learn the right things, and have they found how they want to lead their lives, not committing crimes, or being in that penal system and being in a correctional system, have they learned all the things that we didn't want them to learn, like how to be a better, you know, how to be a better criminal. I think the other, one of the other changes that came out of Major 11 was, that forced Major 11 was, at the time it was passed, juveniles could only be held in a correctional setting until they were 21. And if a juvenile was 16, 17, they did something pretty serious, the public didn't really see that was a long enough time. And I understand that the law has now changed where person committed can be held there until they're 25. So a 17-year-old doing that same offense could now be held 8 years, which maybe is enough time. And in many cases they are held at McLaren or a juvenile correctional setting. And I think generally the effort is more towards treatment, more towards education, and more towards a positive thing rather than just do your time and, you know, we'll see you at the end. Long answer.
Yeah. No, it's okay. So crimes committed by teens today, is it more serious or less serious than 20 years ago? What's the new drug that you want to
follow? We're seeing a lot of this. I mean, we still see a lot of the same stuff, a lot of the property offenses, but I think with the, you know, the changes in drugs, you know, whereas, you know, 5 years ago, whatever, 10 years ago, whatever, it was marijuana, alcohol, you know, now we're seeing methamphetamines. And so some of those changes, it's the same kind of behavior, but the consequences are much more severe for the youth as well as the public. You know, 10 years ago, it was a knife fight, now it's a gun. You know, so some of those things have changed where I think that the behavior is still sort of the same, but the consequences to the youth and to the community are more severe now. There's more. There's a greater damage, a greater opportunity or likelihood of personal harm, people getting hurt.
So is the majority of the crimes drug influenced, or do you think how many of the crimes have we seen are drug influenced?
It's really hard to know because, I mean, we see reports, but unless maybe an officer, you know, highlights it, or unless they're actually charged with possessing drugs, you know, it's sometimes hard to know how much, you know, how drug involved it is. One of the things that we have done here as well is to develop a drug court to deal with young people when they get that first MIP or that first marijuana possession charge. We have another more extensive court where when they have those more serious criminal charges where they are burglarizing for drugs or they are possessing, you know, methamphetamine or selling or whatever. We have a drug court that really has them coming in very frequently before the court. It allows for a lot of monitoring and really, again, promotes treatment. You know, kind of setting, if you've been involved with drugs and alcohol and you're willing to do treatment, there's a very good opportunity for you to move forward and to take care of this in a successful way. If you're not at that point yet, then you're going to get the sanctions and the consequences. Maybe that will help them change their outlook. For example, you know, we'll have kids that get picked up under the influence, maybe it's meth or whatever. You know, they come out to court and, you know, I mean, they are having trouble tracking what's going on. You know, their behavior is very erratic. After they've been in detention for 10 days, 2 weeks, something like that, and they've had a chance to detox a little bit and can now look back and see what their behavior was, be clear. You know, they're much more prone to make good decisions at that point. But, you know, the methamphetamine is so addictive and, you know, such a problem that you kind of, I mean, if treatment is available, then we promote that, but if not, then there is a certain level of community protection and protection of the youth for themselves. They may be forced into drug treatment if their behavior is really a problem for them and their parents or community.
So is there a certain group or race of people that's often linked to a specific crime, or
you know, we haven't done a real good job of tracking offenses by race or by ethnicity. We're actually, with our new data system, that's something that we're moving towards now, and it's something that we're paying attention to. For example, I oversee the detention, our detention contract and kids that are in detention. And that's one of the things we're looking at, is there a higher percentage of one ethnicity over another. You know, just because of Washington County, the breakdown, you know, primarily, I mean, you know, white versus Hispanic versus African American, the majority are white just because that's the population here. So
what age range do you see most coming? Like, is there specific age range where they are?
There is, historically, going back, you know, 10, 15 years, the guideline was sort of that if you were under 12 years of age, you didn't have the maturity or the ability to really understand what you were doing, you know, that you couldn't form criminal intent is what they call it. And 12 is sort of, and 12 is also the guideline for going into detention. 12-year-olds and above can be placed in detention. If you're under 12, a judge really has to look at it first. And it's very, very rare we would detain anybody in custody under 12. Our main range is 12 to 18. The majority of the kids are, you know, 15, 16 is probably the biggest age range of kids that we see. We do see kids younger than that. We've seen, or we see kids as young as 6 and 7 in the juvenile department, and primarily that is because they're doing things in the community that is so dangerous, and a lot of times that's fire play. Kids that are 6, 7, 8, you know, they're starting to set little fires, or they set a fire that, you know, gets out of control. The police are called, and sometimes they will refer those kids, not so much for us to, you know, take them to court and punish them, but really our view at that point is to try and get the youth in, to get a screening done, to see how dangerous are they, is this a real chronic problem, and to give the parents some education in them to try and break that cycle, because, you know, the fire can be so so devastating and have such horrible consequences. The other thing that we're seeing a lot of increase is sexual offenses. There's a big change over the past, you know, 15-20 years over how sex offenders are handled. It used to be pretty hush-hush, and we didn't see a lot. And then as public sentiment grew, public opinion about, you know, sex offenders going to prison, coming out and reoffending, that has come down into the juvenile system as well. And so we now also have a group of counselors here that work specifically with kids that are charged with sexual offenses. Again, to get an evaluation, get an assessment, try and get them into treatment, monitor them very closely so that they're not reoffending. Most of the sexual offenses are not aggressive acts, you know, towards, you know, a young man, towards a young woman. Most of the time it's more of an age difference, you know, adolescent male offending, you know, a young female. Sometimes it's a family member, sometimes it's somebody that they know through the church, you know, sometimes it's somebody at school. But for us, it's more the age difference and having inappropriate contact as opposed to sexually aggressive kinds of things like rape and that kind of stuff. But it is an area, again, it's a specialized area. As people are getting more skilled at evaluating and identifying that, we believe that the treatment is possible and that it can be successful. So that's one area that we're working at again to try and have them not reoffend, because it's such a, it can have such devastating results on the victim.
So what crime is the most serious need more attention to
in juvenile court?
Yeah.
I think probably the sexual offenses is one that we're really paying very, very close attention to. You know, there's so much public opinion on how dangerous that is because of the, you know, devastating effects it can have on the victim. You know, a car is stolen or, you know, something's broken into them, and there you can repay, and you can, it still messes up their sense of security, but it's not like, you know, being intended. So that's an area that we're really paying attention to. We're also really trying to take a close look at the methamphetamine and increase our drug court capabilities now to make that more effective and to work with a larger population of kids. Because right now it's kind of limited, it's kind of pick and choose, but we want to try and expand that so that we can really look at some of the meth. And in the fire setting, you know, those are all real important public safety issues. So those are things that we're probably paying special, you know, attention to and really devoting a lot of time.
So what do you think we can do as a community to help prevent these kind of crimes, or try to help teens to be more less active in crime? Or is there any education or
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things, and one of the areas that we have tried to do, this department receives or has received and does receive now some funds from the state called Juvenile Crime Prevention. One of the problems right now that people complain about is that it seems like kids can't get services until they get into trouble. And so one of the things that we did with some money from the state was to put programs in schools so that some of those kids, when they first start acting out or their parents are starting to have problems, they can get help early on. That's probably one of the most important things, is identifying kids as early as you can and get services in place, with mental health counseling, drug and alcohol treatment, whatever it may be, to try and get that preventative treatment in place early. Part of it is parental capabilities. With whether either single family, single parents, or both parents working, there's much more unsupervised time, and so kids have a greater ability to. There's more time to make some of those decisions. So I think it's, it's just trying. It is education. It's recognizing early on if kids have treatment needs and being able to provide those services. That's the other piece. Mental health is a big issue, and if you don't have insurance, it's pretty tough to get treatment sometimes. So there's some pretty big areas that need, I think, some attention in order to be able to give treatment and equal opportunity for treatment to some of those families that wouldn't otherwise get it. They get it after they come here, because maybe we may mandate it, or we may have some counselors or staff in-house that can provide that. But we kind of want to get away from where they have to get in trouble first. We do parenting education. We do a parent education class here. It's free to the community. We try and make referrals when we get calls from parents, my son won't mind, he won't go to school, what can I do? So we try and give them resources that they can contact instead of just having to, kind of put up with that.
So parents can call here and get information?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We have a, my assessment unit, one different staff is on duty every day of the week, Monday through Friday, just to take calls from the community, and they may say, I think my son has drug and alcohol issues, can you tell me where I might be able to get an evaluation so we can talk to them about that? Or, I've caught them shoplifting, five times, store never will prosecute, what can I do? We can make some suggestions about programs in the community that hopefully they can contact early on. But we really try and give some, and we'll tell them what we can do, we'll tell them what we can't do, what our limits are here, because there are some limits that we have as well.
Do you see a trend in game time, or from the past
20 years? It was real prevalent and real obvious for a period of time, and then it kind of tapered off in terms of the visibility in the community. There's a lot of publicity now about it kind of resurrecting again and increasing again. We do see an increase in that. Actually, we just helped fund a community forum for Washington County last week about warning signs, how to get involved. We have some parenting classes available for parents who think their kids might be getting in that area. So we're trying to work with law enforcement. But, there's some real similarities in terms of whether it be gang behavior or just going out and, doing criminal mischief. There's some similarities in terms of why that may happen. But I think the visibility of the tagging and all that stuff, that seems to be increasing again.
So, about law enforcement, how different are the laws from 1982?
Are they more effective, more, do they counter the problem, or is it? I don't know that they, the actual law itself, laws are always a couple of years behind what the trend is. For example, we had all the identity, when the identity theft started. It takes a while to get caught up with that. People are using computers to make false IDs and to, buy stuff and sell it, steal stuff and sell it on eBay or something like that. It takes a while for laws to catch up with that. So they try and respond to it. Laws are, I think they're well intended. but there's so many variations. I think that the change is requiring, for example, sex offenders, requiring them to register, requiring them to give, samples. I mean, some of it is done more for, record keeping, for being able to track those kids that have been identified as serious offenders because of the nature of their charge. I think the laws just kind of respond to what's happening. The sanctions probably really haven't changed in a lot of ways. Sometimes they adjust for inflation. At one point, theft 2, for example, is considered a class A misdemeanor, meaning an adult can go to jail for a year. 10 years ago, whatever it was anything between, it was like property from a penny up to $50. Well, now we have theft 3, which is from a penny to $50, and we have theft 2, which is 50 to 750, and then anything over 750 is a felony. So that changes, and there's always some response to, the whole issue of overcrowding and whether things should be decriminalized or not. But I think really the laws, I mean, they're just reflective of kind of what's going on, and they try and identify some seriousness, but I think some of them are pretty accurate, some of them I think are not real accurate.
Are they more enforced now, by the police?
I think it just depends a lot on your police, on the ability, the resources that law enforcement has. I think they would say that if they had, 20 more officers, they could, arrest more people, they could do more investigation. So they have to prioritize those things that are really critical to the public, that are public safety issues, and those lesser crimes aren't going to get as much attention. And there's also some limits about what we can do. There's some things that we can respond very strongly to because the youth is eligible for detention or they may be placed out of their home. Some of those lesser offenses, there's not a lot legally that we can always do too. And to spend a lot of money to get to a point where you really can't do much about it, it's not a good use of resources. And I think it's, so we try and do the best with the resources we have, put our efforts into where we think we'll get the most benefit, and also recognize, the public safety. If kids are a danger, then we need to be off the street. I think, I don't know what they would say, I would think more efficient. I mean, just in terms of tracking, being able to record and piece together, similarities of, crimes and that kind of stuff. I honestly don't know a whole lot about what their view would be. There's computer crimes and, all the counterfeiting and all that stuff. I'm sure that there's, skilled officers that can go in and look inside the computer and pull all the stuff off the hard drive. Some of the internet stuff that we're seeing where they're, adults are trying to, make contact with minors and stuff. I think, certainly the technology has helped, maybe helped them do some tracking and be able to conclude those cases. But in terms of how much it's a benefit to them, I don't know what they'd say.
So how the way your department utilizes information, is it more efficient than how do you utilize them? They're more organized right now than they were years ago?
Probably one of the two significant changes, I think. One is, you know, 15 years ago, pretty much every county had their own way of keeping track of their clients, of their cases. Over the years, that has continued to be developed. So Oregon now has a statewide data system. So, you know, 15 years ago, if a person was arrested in Washington County, unless we called Clackamas County or unless we called Multnomah County, we wouldn't necessarily know if they had been in trouble in those counties. Now, all 36 counties are on the same data system. So if I get, if we get a call on a youth saying, you know, we just arrested this youth, we want to know if you, you know, want to put in custody or what do you want us to do with them, we can type their name in and we'll know instantly, you know, whether they've had any contact statewide. We'll know aliases, we'll know, there's a whole bunch of different ways that we can sort information now. So that's probably one of the key things. It's been much better, and we can know, well, yeah, this person just moved up from Salem and had all kinds of trouble down there, and they just left. Now they're up here, kind of, you know, you need to take care of everything. So that's probably one huge improvement. And I think the other thing is the skill, the risk screen that I talked about. When we do that interview with the family and the youth, we can record the kinds of risks that are being reported to us, and there is data and there is evidence that suggests that certain risk factors and certain numbers of factors merit increased levels of supervision. So it's a nice way of looking at the information you get and helping you make decisions about how the case is going to or should be managed. It's not the answer to everything, but it does give you good information. And probably the third piece I think that's most important for Oregon is there's a statewide trend and effort to document programs. You know, if you're running a program, a treatment program, how do you know if it's working? And so the state will set guidelines as to, you know, what are your outcomes? You know, how many clients did you have? How many reoffended after they left your treatment? How many completed treatment? And there's clear evidence that some programs are more effective than others. So that will help us develop, you know, if the young person does need treatment or needs a placement, we get a better sense of which programs are going to be most effective. You know, we know here we have a program here and one here. If we don't know anything about them, it's kind of a toss-up about where we're going to send them. But if we know one is very effective, obviously it's better to send the youth to that program and get the most impact we can. So I think those are probably the three main ones, the risk assessment and the statewide database and being able to gather information, and then the evidence-based treatment programs.
So is there anything else you'd like to tell me about your experience in the juvenile department?
No, I think it's, I guess probably the last thing would be personally, I think Washington County is very fortunate. We have a very well-respected department. Not all counties are seeing the decline that we have in referrals. And the programs that we have here, we have better outcomes, better performance measures than many other counties in the state. For example, we track kids if they reoffend or not. And Washington County has a lower rate than the state average, and it's much lower than most counties. So we feel we have a very good department. We really push relationships with families and with kids. We push treatment. We push accountability, and really trying to, I think, a holistic approach, not just, okay, the kid did a shoplift, he's the problem, we're going to ignore everything else. I think we really try and focus on the family and look at it holistically. And the other benefit we have is we don't have much turnover. We have staff that stay here a long time. So you're not always having to, you know, train people, and we have new people come in as programs grow. But generally speaking, people stay here, and I think do a good job, and it's been a great opportunity for me. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. one of the things that we do, I usually do about once a month, is have job shadows come in. Yeah. I had one yesterday, actually, and not as many this year, but you know, usually like once a month during the school year, we'll have job shadows come in with high school students, and we're really trying to do more public education. So if Century, I'm not sure, oh, you said it was advanced placement in history. But if there is a class or a group or whatever at Century that want information about the department, we now have a kind of a public education program that we're happy to come out to really try and get the community more involved and to let them know we'd like to be partners with families and youth and community. And we're all in the county together, so we need to do the best we can. I think it's great you guys are doing this program.
Yeah.